How fun is that? And I guess for the minute and a half that we have left, any kind of like last minute things that anyone would like to mention? Maybe like I don't know what they call it, like wishes for the new year?
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to me and Tammy and Sonia this year. It's been the first year that we've had the gap, and so that's really exciting. And I hope everyone has a good new year and a good holiday if you're celebrating.
Yes,
Appreciate you guys.
I very much appreciate all the fans and the super fans of the show, and also all the listeners here in Portland and across the world. It's been a difficult year, unprecedented times, as Althea loves to say. But we're here. We're gonna, be loud about it and embrace all the community. So, this is for you, for us, for all of us together. And Sonia, thank you so much for literally being there for us to be on the air, because we would not be able to do it without you. So thank
Difficult and
you so
uncertain.
much.
Yes.
Difficult and uncertain, unprecedented. Thank you all so much. My
Plans
name is
ahead.
Tammy. This is The Gap on KBOO Portland with my better halves. That's two. Althea Billings and Sonia. My better quarters, I guess? I don't know.
Thirds.
Math is hard.
Third.
Third.
We're a throuple.
All right. We gotta
Thank
wrap
you all
up.
so much. Big shout out to Dr. Jill Biden.
Shout out Joe Biden. Shout out Community College. Goodbye.
Yeah. See ya.
And this is still KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. Coming up next is Veterans Voice with your host, Marvin Simmons. Stay tuned.
Portland calling. Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in Corvallis, 91.9 FM Hood River, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. You can hear our earlier shows at KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Miss Sonia is engineering the show and doing a great job as usual. I want to say hello to my friends Gary and Darla back in Nebraska. Gary and I were in the Army together, and he was down in the Delta in Vietnam, and I was up in the Highlands. Gary and Darla and my first wife, Sue Ann, and I, in 1971, went to the Vietnam Veterans March Against the War, which was amazing. And I'd also like to say hello to Tracy and the twins. Tracy's my neighbor up here on the hill, but they're living in Spain for the next year, which is really good for the twins. Tracy speaks fluent Spanish, so they won't have any problems there. Charlie Pride, the African-American country singer, passed away. He was also a veteran. Charlie Pride got drafted in 1956 into the Army, and he just passed away a few days ago. He was a great singer, and people are going to miss that wonderful voice he had. I want to talk a little bit before I get into what I want to talk about today, and that's COVID-19. I got a text from Angie, which a lot of you remember. Angie was the co-host with me for years before she moved up to Washington. She was a Navy Gulf War veteran, and we text a lot and keep in contact because she's really a good friend. Right now she's over in Eastern Oregon helping her. Well, she's doing it. She's a carpenter, and she's remodeling her mom and dad's home. And she texted me the other day and said that she had COVID-19 and that she was doing okay, that she's feeling a lot better and should be, you know, out of the death zone pretty soon. So she said she was the second one to get it in that in the county. I don't remember the county she's in over there, but she thinks she got it at the grocery store. So you can get it about anywhere. And also over in Idaho, my niece has COVID-19. She also has breast cancer, so I'm really worried about her. Her daughter has COVID-19, and her granddaughter also has COVID-19, and Mia's only 6 years old, so children can get this too. So everybody needs to wear their masks, you know, stay 6 feet apart, and definitely wash your hands, you know, as much as you can, because this virus is, you know, just got the whole world. So we need to really fight back. We got the inoculations coming now, but I just read where Oregon's not going to get as much for the second round as they were promised. So we'll have to see how that goes. And but the first liners are getting it, doctors, nurses, and people who work in nursing homes, and the nursing home folks who live in those nursing homes get it, because they really took it hard. I think the VA Veterans Hospital, they're going to be getting it really, really soon. I'm glad, because my friend Christy works up there, and I hope that she gets that shot soon. I don't know when the rest of us are going to get it, but I hope it's soon. You know, something that's with this election, and you know, Trump getting voted out of office and saying he didn't and all this stuff, you know, a lot of people weren't paying attention to Yemen. And Yemen has 5 1,000 children in Yemen have been killed with these weapons that the United States has sold to Saudi Arabia. And right now, 400,000 children are malnourished in Yemen. We kind of took our eye off, people have kind of took their eye off that one, but it's still going on over there. Children are dying every day, if not from the bombing from the Saudi Arabians, but from malnutrition. And that shouldn't happen. I was checking and seeing how much weaponry that the United States has sold to Saudi Arabia, and it's been $68.2 billion worth of weapons they've sold to Saudi Arabia. And that is just a lot of weaponry. And we need to, you know, not let that go under the radar, that those poor children are dying. I saw a picture of some of those children, and it's just horrible, just horrible. You know, children in every war takes it tough. You know, children get the worst of it during a war. You know, it doesn't matter what war, where it's at, children really, really get it. I was working on this show, but it was going to be about armies, military, how the governments around the world use their military. You know, they say one thing, but they're actually doing something else. But something came up, and I decided I'm going to hold off on that one, and I'll do it next month. But I was talking to my friends in Vietnam, and one of my buddies who lives over there said that his good friend had just passed away, and she was a long-haired warrior. She was a woman, a female guerrilla fighter in the southern part of Vietnam during the war. And that just got me, you know, thinking about it. I had met some of these women before, because my late wife, Laurel, was getting stuff ready to write a book about the women who fought in the South. And so I decided that I was going to do this show on those women. I was also going to do about the Vietnam Veterans Against the War taking over the Statue of Liberty, and I'll talk about next time on that one of the takeover of the Statue of Liberty. But there's an article that I found that I really got to me, and it was called "Hardcore Women of Vietnamese History, Vo Thi Sao." And I'm going to do that now. Vo Thi Sao was no ordinary schoolgirl. She was just 14 when she tossed a grenade at a group of French soldiers, killing one and injuring 12 before escaping into a crowded market. A few years later, in 1952, aged just 19, she was executed by a French firing squad. You have to remember that the French had been controlling Vietnam since about 1858, and what they were doing to the French were doing to the Vietnamese is just taking everything they had and sending it to France. And the violence that was done to the Vietnamese people by the French is well documented, and a lot of the people, Vietnamese people, were just murdered by the French, during the battles against the French, but also just the everyday life that the French looked at the Vietnamese as less than human beings. And that's what, you know, that's what they want the people to think, that the people they're going after and killing are less than human. But Vietnam had just had enough of it, and they weren't going to put up with it. Minutes before her death, a priest asked if she wanted to confess, and she simply replied, "I only regret not finishing destroying all the colonialists and the people who betrayed this nation." She then demanded her captors take off her blindfold. "No need to cover my eyes. I want to look at this beloved country for the last time, and I have the courage to look directly at your muzzles." She refused to kneel and calmly sang Tien Quan Ka, the then national anthem of the North Vietnam, before she was shot dead. Her last words were reportedly, "Down with the French colonialists, long-lasting independence, Vietnam, long live President Ho." Bold and fearless, Sao had been seen as a heroine and a martyr beloved by her country ever since. She was 19 years old. Growing up in poverty, the daughter of a coachman and noodle seller, Sao had to help her parents to earn a living and blame the French colonists for their struggles, particularly after 1946, when they stormed her hometown of Dat Dao, Redland, in what is now Ba Zai Vung Tao province in the south of Vietnam. Vung Tao is really a nice place. Fearing the loss of their homeland, people in Dat Dao were encouraged to participate in the fighting against the French colonialism, and Sao joined the resistance. Remember, she was only 14. By 1947, 14-year-old Sao was accepted to be a member of Dat Dao Squadron volunteer team to assist the Viet Minh, the Vietnamese Communist guerrilla fighters, which, you know, I've talked about on this show before, that Ho Chi Minh, when he came back into Vietnam, he started the Viet Minh organization to fight the French. I'm sorry if I'm making a lot of noise here. And worked to deliver officers to establish spies on the enemy and bring news back to the Viet Minh. She quickly became known for keeping a low profile, at times almost seeming invisible. There's really a good picture of her. She at 19, 14, 15, 16, she looked just really young. One of her standout achievements was her role in disturbing the French National Day of Celebration in July 1948. Though knowing it was a hard and dangerous task, Sao insisted on carrying out the mission. The night before the meeting, she hid a grenade in the corner of a market by a nearby stage. The morning when everyone was waiting for the entrance of the provisional head, she threw the grenade at the stage, killing one, injuring 12, causing the meeting to disband and consolidating the Viet Minh power in the area. She also carried out several assassination attempts against the notorious Cai Tong, who worked for the French authorities as the head guard at Dat Dao district. Once she even threw a grenade directly at his face, and explosion severely injured him, though he still survived. The event was said to put French occupiers on their back foot, leaving them terrified of the Viet Minh. She was just one of many, many guerrilla fighters at that young age to fight against the French, and then later they fought against the Americans' occupation of Vietnam. Sure, they could not publicly execute her when she was 19 years old. They smuggled her and other revolutionary prisoners to Con Dao prison on Con Son Island, where it is said that her intensity and wide-eyed put fear into the French soldiers. And Con Dao prison is a really notorious prison, and I'll talk a little bit about it after I read the rest of the story about this young woman. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it was yet another grenade incident that led to Sal's finally being apprehended in 1949 as people were rushing about on the streets of Dachau while preparing for Tet, the Lunar New Year. Tet is like everything, every holiday combined into one time of the year, and that's Tet, the Lunar New Year. Sal walked barefoot among the crowds carrying a basket of what looked like vegetables, but hidden inside were two grenades that she would use in her last fight. Her plan was to kill Kade and Cao Suot, two Vietnamese who had devoted themselves to the French authorities, killed many innocent, and even executing Vietnamese soldiers those two had. Sal threw the first grenade, injuring both men, but when she threw the second, it failed to detonate, and she was subsequently arrested before being tortured in the Bazai prison for the next 3 months. During those 3 months at Bazai prison, French colonialists used barbarous torture methods in an attempt to get Sal to confess and give evidence about her superiors, but she refused, not giving a single word. Next, they moved her to Cam Chi Hoa prison in Saigon, where she is said to have lifted the other imprisoned soldiers and acted as a rallying point for the Viet Minh in prison. Sal also took part in much resistance against the French authorities in prison, such as demanding to improve people's lives in jail and never cowering to her jailers, who were said to fear her. The French occupiers feared the spirit of this hard-as-nails schoolgirl, as her ability to inspire the Viet Minh. So they soon put her to trial and sentenced her to death, despite the fact that she had not yet turned 18, receiving a huge wave of disapproval. The protest in society, both from the Vietnamese and the French, she was a minor and female, they were forced to give her a stay of execution. Sal was accordingly held at Cam Chi Hoa until January of 1952. As they could not publicly execute her when she was 19 years old, they smuggled her and a number of other revolutionaries to, like I said, Condao prison. She was executed on an island in secret on January 23rd, 1952. The night before her death, she had admitted to be a member of the Communist Party of Vietnam due to her incredible bravery and tenacity. She had been venerated by the whole nation and ever since has been a national martyr. It is said that during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which effectively saw the end of the French presence in Vietnam, Viet Minh soldiers would scream her name as they rallied to fight against the French. In 1994, they even made a film about her, Nhu Con Dai Dat Do, The Girl of Dat Zao, starring the famous singer Tinh Tui. I've heard her sing. Vo Tu Sao has long since been recognized as a symbol of Vietnam's youthful fighting spirit, bravery, particularly in the face of those who dare to conquer the nation, and gave her and her grave on Con Son Island is a place of pilgrimage for many people to this day, who come to pay their respect and honor the fierce and determined young schoolgirl gorilla. I've been to that grave. It's really pretty interesting. But I want to talk about Cong Son, Cong Dao, Cong Son Island. It was made by the French. It's about 100 miles off the coast of southern part of Vietnam. And so the French made it in 1862, I believe, and it was used to put revolutionaries in this prison because it was so far away. There's a graveyard there that has about 10,000 to 20, I think they said 10,000 to 20,000 graves. A lot of the graves aren't marked. That's why they're not really sure how many are there. But the prison, there all through Vietnam, from the north to the south during the fight against the French, there were all these prisons all through the country. And also at that time, the French were still using the guillotine to get rid of some of the revolutionary fighters. And so I don't remember seeing one at Cong Dao, but the prison at Cong Dao, I think there was like three of them on that island. Now that island is a resort, a real expensive resort, but they've left up the prison. It's a museum type prison now. But that's where they had these tiger cages. And these tiger cages were cells that were about 5 by 8. And they were, on the top of the cells were bars, and with a ramp down the middle where the guards would walk and see what was going on in these cells. The prisoners got very little food, very little water, no medicine, and they were also, at night they would be put in shackled looking thing. What it was, they would lay down over these huge concrete slabs, and the guards would put this bar through them, through these shackled looking things, and shackle them down for the night. There were people who had been in those shackles for years and years, and when they finally got out of that prison, I'll talk about it too. They were crippled. A lot of the people were crippled. A lot of the women were crippled. And there's also on the prison, there's these huge open bay looking part of the prison where they did the same thing to the people. Mostly these were men. Women were usually in the tiger cages, and some men. But they would also at night would put them in those shackles at night. Also, the prison guards, before, when the French were doing it, the French had a Vietnamese who had, you know, joined the French army or whatever, and they were some of the guards there, and very violent. The violence was just unbelievable on these prisons, the beatings, the torture of these people. This included the women. When the United States came into the war, the United States took over these prisons. I mean, it was ran by the South Vietnamese, but the Americans were also involved in them, to include the tiger cages. An American who was working in Vietnam, I don't remember who he was working for, his name was Don Luce. And Don Luce, one of his friends was sent to that prison and tortured, and she died. And Don Luce was very angry about that, and he got a hold of some American senators, I believe they were senators, and told them about them, and they got to go. They went to Cong Dao prison and looked and saw what was going on in the prisons, especially those tiger cages. They took pictures of the tiger cages and the women within these tiger cages, and the violence and the way they looked. They were skinny, they were thirsty, their clothes were in rags. And if Don said, in his, he has a book, I can't remember what the name of the book is, but he said that when they would sing revolutionary songs and everything, that the guards would pour lye down on them, and then pour water on it to start to burn these people. And Don Luce told the senators about that. So, you know, the prisons, it was just, like I was saying, there's prisons all over over Vietnam. And then after when the Americans took over, there was just the prisons in the South. And in Saigon itself, there was, I can't remember how many, 20, maybe 20 or more prisons in Saigon itself. And there's also another prison, I can't think of the name of the island. It's also a resort now, but it was also a prison, and that's where some of the leadership that became the leadership of the North, Lê Xuân, some of those leadership of the Vietnamese Communist Party escaped from. But Miss Sonia, can you go ahead and play the second song for me, please?
We're treated like tools 'cause we act like fools, believing all that we're told. Yeah, government lies and people die, the story's way too old. People read the Constitution, it's where we'll find solution. Perpetual war, we don't want it no more, and ruling by fear ain't welcome here. So use your mind and tell me how we can end the insanity now. We rush into war, we don't declare them no more. Our wars aren't fought to be won. With all our might, we don't know what's right. We don't even know when we're done. People read the Constitution, it's where we'll find solution. Perpetual war, we don't want it no more, and ruling by fear ain't welcome here. So use your mind and tell me how we can end the insanity now. Of law and justice for all are what help make America great. And the Bill of Rights is still worth the fight, and I don't ever say it's too late. People read the Constitution, it's where we'll find solution. Perpetual war, we don't want it no more, and ruling by fear ain't welcome here. So use your mind and tell me how we can end the insanity now.
Yeah, that's a pretty good song. End the insanity now, war. They just keep doing it. You know, even though now that you know, they don't have, you know, these huge battles like they had before in Iraq and Afghanistan, they still have troops all over the world, and there's troops getting killed constantly in these war, in these low intensity warfare. They just don't put it on the news anymore. The only time that you hear about it is when some soldier gets killed, and his body is brought back home. Is the only time, you know, that you really hear about it. But getting back to Condao Island, Consan Island, and the prison at Condao. The senators who saw that, the congressmen and senators who saw that, took pictures of it and took them back, and it caused a lot of trouble. But they really didn't close those prisons until 1975, when the country was was unified, and they brought these people out, and and then the world could see exactly the horrors that had been going on in those prisons, and the death and destruction of the human body. What one you think about what one human being can do to another human being is just atrocious. You know, even in the war itself, but like in those prisons over there, I think the last person to be killed by a guillotine, I think, was 1961. That they had this traveling guillotine, and they would go from district to district, and you know, execute prisoners. But you know, women have been part of fighting for their independence and the rights of others for as long as there's been people on this earth. And women have fought in the Civil War in this country and the Revolutionary War in this country. They don't get the credit they deserve. The you know, fighting for freedom and the rights of people, of working class people all around the world. You see women part of the movements to free people from dictatorships, from these crazy people who, once they get in power, change their way of thinking and cause such destruction and such violence. In Vietnam, it's really interesting. In Vietnam, they call the long-haired warriors. The history of the Vietnam, they were a unique unit that contributed a great deal to the war against Americans, consisting entirely of females. The force known as Long-Haired Army was formed during the Dong Khoi General Uprising that started throughout the South in the 1960s after the Party Central Committee Resolution Number 15 was issued, combining politics and armed struggle. This is the same time that Central Office of South Vietnam was made, and that's was the center part of the war in South Vietnam that included the Viet Cong, and which is the National Liberation Front, and the North Vietnamese Army. It directed the war in the South, and they lasted the whole war too. After the great victory of the spring of 75, this long-haired army continued to contribute to the building of the armed forces protecting the nation that had recently been reunited. Such female fighters, despite their small and slender figures, faced immense danger to stop the destruction of villages. They also launched the insurgency at the Dong Khoi movement throughout the southern region that became widely known beyond the borders of Vietnam. It was started by women. The National Liberation Front was started by women, women revolutionaries, breaking the enemy grip. Vietnam has now been reunified for 45 years, but 86-year-old Cai Le Xu in Tang Tang Binh commune in the southern province of Binh Che is still overwhelmed when she recalls the Dong Khoi movement and the Long-Haired Army, the movement that broke out in Binh Tre, which is down in the Delta, before spreading throughout the South, was a consequence of accumulated resent, she said. The U.S. and the U.S.-backed administration of the Republic of Vietnam under the head No Dinh Diem broke the 1954 Geneva Agreement, making South Vietnam a new type colony and a military base for the American Empire. Diem issued Law 1059, publicly placing the communists outside the law, resulting in the execution of thousands and the imprisonment of even more who were suspected to have communist affiliations, which led to the uprising to break the shackles of the regime. These women, there's a group of women in Hue that I'd met. In Hue was the capital of Vietnam. That's where the citadel is. That's where in 1968 Tet Offensive, that it lasted, the battle lasted for, I can't remember how long, but it was the last place to go. And this was behind enemy lines, Vietnam's female spies who helped change the war. And it's a really interesting story about these women who fought this war. They were young. These women were young. Like the woman I just talked about, she was 14 when she started fighting. She was 19 when she was executed. And like I said, I've seen her grave at Kong Dao prison there on Kong Sang Island. By day, Nguyen Thi Hoa sold conical hats on the streets of Hue in southern Vietnam. At night, she funneled secrets to communist army handlers who were posed to launch an audacious assault on the city that would reshape the Vietnam War. Hoa was part of the Perfume River Squad, a top-secret female combat unit formed in 1967 and bound by the communist propaganda slogan, "When the enemy comes to your home, even the women should fight." And stapled this all together. The offensive, whose 50th anniversary would be marked on January 31st with an official ceremony at Ho Chi Minh City, which was Saigon, they renamed it, was a military failure for the Northern forces. But it swung public opinion decisively away from the anti-communist fight, ultimately leading to the American pullout. Women were integral in the communist Northern battle against American foreign invaders, working mainly in non-combat roles for most of the war as spies and guides, cooks and messengers, mules and nurses for the injured. Using her cover as a street trader, Hoa gleaned details on enemy movement in the strategically important imperial city of Hue, feeding information to commanders from the north. It was a role driven by conviction in the communist cause. "I wanted to liberate myself, liberate my homeland, and liberate other women. There was no other path besides joining the revolution," she told AFP in Hue, where she settled after the war. That's the news agency, AFP. She was just 17 when she joined the war effort as a spy and secret messenger in 1965. 2 years later, she joined the Perfume River unit. The Perfume River is this beautiful river that goes right through Hue and goes all the way to the sea, named after the waterway that intersects Hue City, a role so risky she didn't even tell her family that she was part of this unit. War came to Hue, then the third largest city in Vietnam, in the early hours of January 31st, 1968. This is the Tet Offensive. It was key target of the Tet Offensive, a series of surprise attacks across southern Vietnam by more than 80,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters. Remember, the Viet Cong were the National Liberation Front. The attacks, which also hit Saigon, stunned U.S. troops and their southern Vietnam allies. Casualties were massive on both sides, especially the North, which lost an estimated 58,000 people. The shock assault on Hue saw the citadel swiftly fall to the North, and for days, a blue and red flag of the national with a yellow star, a symbol of communist Hanoi and its allies. And also that was the National Liberation Flag, the Viet Cong flag. But U.S. Marines and Southern troops countered, taking 26 days to wrench back the city block by block in a battle that would become the longest and one of the bloodiest in the Vietnam War. With casualties high, the Perfume River unit was called on to join the fight. Until then, they had mostly been ferrying injured fighters from the front lines. The women dug in around markets and sports stadium, hurling grenades and shooting her AK-47 rifle. Wa says it was a battle for survival. We just kept shooting. If we didn't shoot, they would have shot us. So we just kept fighting, she said. Wa is now 69 years old. Who was doused in Agent Orange during the war and later gave birth to a disabled son. The use of female fighters shows how desperate they, the North, were, said Mark Bowden, author of Way 1968, which is a stupid statement on his part. The women had been fighting in the war since the 50s. Their efforts were recognized in a poem by Hanoi's revolutionary leader Ho Chi Minh, who died in 1969 before the war's end, praising them for having crushed the bones of American soldiers and crystallizing their heroism, which is still celebrated today, which it is. When we received that letter, everyone cried, fellow Perfume River Unit fighter Juan T. number 68. Told the news agency at her home in Hue, sitting under a commemorative plate of Uncle Ho. We didn't expect that. We were just a small unit, and so many people died. The nod from Uncle Ho came too late for four members of the unit who perished during the Battle of Hue. My comrades died, and our anger mounted, as did our determination to fight to get revenge for our sister, the soft-spoken grandmother told the news agency. Two more died later in the war. Just five are still alive. No and Wa regularly visit the cemetery where some of their fallen comrades are buried on the outskirts of Hue, a city transformed from a pile of rubble 50 years ago to a tourist hotspot today. Although they weren't the only women to take up arms in the Vietnam War, their reputation as fierce fighters inspired others to join the war, both as soldiers and behind the front lines. The Perfume River Unit were a source of motivation for liberation soldiers and other women to join the war effort, according to Cao Hue Hung, director of the Revolutionary Museum in Hue. I've been in that museum, and it's really, really nice. They really respect the people that fought in the war. They respect the women who fought in that war. And it's really interesting that when Laurel was getting stuff ready for her book, that she never got to finish because she passed away. But we met a whole lot of these women. We met some of the women that were in the North Vietnamese Army that went south. A lot of them were truck drivers. A lot of them worked to rebuild the Ho Chi Minh Trail when it was bombed by the Americans. And then we met a lot of the women who were the guerrilla fighters in the south. These women are just amazing. There's one woman that lives in Saigon, and I don't know her real name, but she goes by Danny. And she was one of her and her sister were guerrilla fighters in the war, and she took Laurel and I around to meet these other women. We went down as far into the Mekong Delta to meet these women, and most of them had gotten married when after the war. Some of them had children who were deformed because of Agent Orange, because in the Delta they really sprayed a lot of Agent Orange to kill all the hiding places for the Viet Cong soldiers down in the south. So a lot of those women, you know, had still a lot of steel bursts, and a lot of health problems. And she introduced us to this one woman who had started it in the war when she was like 13, 14 years old, and she had been captured and also tortured. She had lost part of her left arm in a battle, and she talked about her mother who had fought against the French, who was very, very interesting. The mother was really interesting, and she talked about how that the French Foreign Legion soldiers were, how brutal they were, and how they would come into villages and just cause so much trouble and so much damage, and then just walk away like nothing happened. She talked about she was one of the first women who actually got together and wanted, and took over a fort, a Vietnamese government fort, without firing a shot. They started working on this, the soldiers that the South Vietnamese soldiers in this, in the camp. You know, they would stand at outside the camps and talk to them about their mothers and about their sisters and about their children, and how that the other soldiers were raping the women in the village, and so many of the children had been, the young men had been taken into the South Vietnamese army, and they talked to them for a long time, and finally they went one night and they were at the front gate talking to these soldiers, and the soldiers opened the front gate and walked out. They didn't have to fire a shot. The women talked them out of it, out of fighting the war. And so the women had a very, very important part of the war in Vietnam. You couldn't really tell, because you just couldn't tell who was on whose side. There was never any way to really tell. I remember talking to one of the women. She was a doctor. She had been a doctor in the Mekong Delta, and she was telling how she had to operate in swamps and how she had to do all this work under bombardment and from the Americans. And she talked about how many people died of their wounds, and how many children that were, you know, crippled from the war. And Lorella and I also ran into her again up in Hanoi. In this house we lived at was right a couple blocks away from a hospital that she had taken over, and we would go over there and have meals with her and talk to her, and she would tell us all these stories about how bad it was. She had lost two husbands in the war. Two husbands had been killed, and how now she was a widower again, and that she had two children that were fully grown. One was a doctor, and one was a school teacher. And she talked about how down in the Delta, how the people in the villages would help them. They would never tell where they were at. They would never tell the South Vietnamese Army where the hospitals were. They would sneak in band-aids and all the other kind of medical equipment through the jungles into this hospital, and medicines. They would steal medicines from the Army, South Vietnamese Army, and from the American Army. And she said that they got a lot of their information from American soldiers who had a habit of talking about what they were going to do. You know, they'd find a Vietnamese girl that they really cared a lot about, and she could get them talking, and they found out a lot about when there was going to be troop movements and where they were going to go and what they were going to do and all this. And so there were the whole National Liberation Front was built on people talking, you know, talking. The spies that would talk to the American soldiers, like I talked about, and a lot of the there was prostitutes in these taverns or bars were also were spies, and they would tell, you know, give a lot of information to the army, the North Vietnamese National Liberation Front Army. And when the war was over, I asked about what happened to the women who were the prostitutes during the war, what happened to them after the war. And she told me that what they did, what the government did, was retrain these women. They would, you know, teach them other jobs. They would send them to schools. They would, you know, there was a place up in Pleiku where they would send these women to get straight, because a lot of them were drug addicts. There were a lot of the women were drug addicts, and so there was these places all through the country. But the one I knew about was up in Pleiku, and that's where they would send these women to get cleaned up and retrain them for jobs, and then they would send them home. And if they wanted to go back to their village where they came from, they would take them back to their village. If they wanted to go someplace else, they would take them someplace else. But they considered them, those women, as casualties of war. And so they took care of them. They took care of those women. And after the war, after 75, after the war, and they disbanded, the Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front, was disbanded, and the North Vietnamese Army took over all the responsibility. The people went back, the Viet Cong National Liberation Front people went back to their villages. The vice president of the new government of Vietnam was a guerrilla fighter. She was the vice president, and she helped found the National Liberation Front. And she was just a great woman. I'm looking at a picture of her right now, but I just can't remember her name. I'd met her before up in Hanoi, but I can't remember her name. I guess that's all a part of growing old, huh? Well, Sonia, I want to thank you for doing such a great job today. And I want to thank all of our listeners that keep us going on this show and keep the revolution going. I'll be back on January 15th at 9 a.m. Thanks again, Sonia, and there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we want with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed 1,000,000 men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I
when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. I ain't marching anymore.
Are listening to KBOO Portland.
Want to show your support for volunteered powered radio while also getting ways to save money? When you donate $10 or more to KBOO on GiveGuide, you'll get free access to coupons and discounts on the Chinook Book mobile app. So donate to KBOO on GiveGuide today